CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about what, Colin?
Comics?
There we go.
Graphic novels, whatever is the trendy expression of the day.
You know what's funny is actually I was talking to my one of my professors at school about... I've lent him Palestine, and I lent him Seferi Garage, and he's read Mao, he's read Persepolis. And for one of my papers I'm planning on doing in school is going to be on Chester Brown's Louis Riel and about libertarianism. In it, and he said, "Oh yeah, yeah, libertarian comic," and he felt all bad saying comic. I'm like, that's fine. I actually prefer comic because it feels less flighty. This is the Inkstuds out of UBC CITR 101.9 FM. It's a sunny day in Vancouver. I'm loving it. Are you loving it, Colin?
Yes.
Our guest today is Dave Sim. He is the man behind 300 issues of Cerebus. And he has two new projects coming out, specifically for the majority of the discussion will be Glamourpuss, which would be the reason we played fashion, because Glamourpuss is about fashion.
Nice tie-in.
I tried my best.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Colin. How are you doing? Aren't you going to mention that Colin Upton is the dean of Canadian mini comics?
They already know that.
We remind them every week.
It's always worth repeating, though, that Colin is actually the dean of Canadian mini comics.
They see me around all the time. They're bored by me. So.
He's the dean in the School of Hard Knocks.
He sure is.
And also for people more tie-in, because you know we're in Canada, proud Canadians, Dave is a Canadian as well. So he's you're a bastion of Canadian cartooning, one might say. Does that feel right?
Do you feel like a bastion?
Really bad, but that sounded good. Whatever you were getting to there.
I said you're a bastion of Canadian cartooning. Is that better?
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, I just
everybody can huddle around me when times get bad.
Feel the warmth.
That's what a good bastion is all about. As far as I'm, that was bastion that you said.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Like I say, it's a bad connection. I just wanted to make sure that was. That was how that ended, bastion.
Yeah, no, we'll save the negative comments for another day.
Okay, when I'm not here.
That's how we roll. So Glamourpuss, your latest project, Secret Project number 2, I guess, is the precursor title you gave it. You've been doing 100 hours of online exposure, submitting yourself to the... Wide web.
That ended yesterday, and right now I'm in Columbus, Ohio for the Space Small Press and Alternative Comics Expo, March 1st and 2nd. And I'll tell you, for somebody who doesn't have internet and doesn't have a television, I am just starting to realize how badly hypnotized you get after 100 hours of staring at a computer screen for an entire month.
Did it surprise you doing this, the online message boards? Was it what you're expecting, or was it something different, a different beast altogether?
I didn't really expect anything, because the only other time that I had been on there was in March of 2004, when the week that issue 300 of Cerebus shipped, I went on the Cerebus Yahoo discussion group, which is really the preeminent group of people who are the most devoted Cerebus readers, and I went on live from the Kitchener Library for I think about 2 hours. So that was really the only other experience that I had, and it was a little weird then, and it hasn't gotten any less weird since then.
The one thing I noticed, I didn't partake in the message board exchange. I don't want to talk too much about message board stuff, because really it's not that exciting, but it seemed like it was just the same people in different locations.
Yeah, there was there's a lot of duplication, and there's one of the things was that I was doing it live from a comic book store in Kitchener, looking for heroes on Ontario Street South, and so I was sort of confined by their business hours. They were open till 6 Monday and Tuesday, and then 7 o'clock Wednesday through Friday. And that's really the time when everybody's at work and is supposed to be working. But a few people were stealing a few minutes here and there to ask pertinent questions. But then I imagine they'd vanish back into their workplace and then come back and check 40 minutes later to see if I got to them or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting experiment.
Do you think it's something to be repeated, or is it just that was enough?
We'll see how many glamour puss I sell. if sales go through the roof, I'll probably take up residence on the internet on a percentage basis. Nothing I like better than
sales.
Staring at a computer screen for 100 hours. It's good for you.
Well, it's
solid, yeah.
It's some people's lives.
It's mine sometimes, unfortunately. But there's something wrong with me. So Glamour Puss, let's just get right into the meat of it. What is Glamour Puss?
It's basically an excuse for me to draw fashion models in my best Al Williamson style. It's one of those things that having done the world's first 6,000-page graphic novel, there comes a certain point where, if you haven't got any street cred at that point, you're never going to have street cred anyway. So you might as well do the thing that that you enjoy the most. And basically, that's the starting point. I want to draw lots of photorealism pictures of very, very pretty women in very nice clothes. And that really leads over to the Alex Raymond school. Alex Raymond, in addition to creating the more famous Flash Gordon, also did a detective strip called Rip Kirby, which was really the first of what I consider the photorealism comics. So basically what I'm doing is trying to learn as much as I can about the drawing style that he basically invented, that involves a lot of very thin brushwork. Most of the work that I did on Cerebus was done with the Hunt 102 crow quill pen nib, some brush, but usually just for large areas of solid black or any line that I couldn't get thick enough out of the pen nib. So that's really on the technical side, the part that I'm enjoying there is really trying to understand the thinking behind the very spontaneous brush style that he did. And I'm really not a spontaneous artist by nature, so it's one of those, it comes out a whole lot better if I don't work quite as hard at it, but I'm such a hard worker by nature that getting out of my own way is really the biggest problem so far.
Well, it seems comparative the art styles between Glamour Puss and Cerebus. I mean, Cerebus was very, I guess, loose, a lot of caricaturisms where you kind of over-exaggerate people, and then Glamour Puss, you're kind of working at confining yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's of all the styles that I worked in, and on Cerebus, I really did move across the spectrum. Cerebus himself is a cartoon aardvark, and then it's all characters in the real world, the funny animal in the world of humans idea that the late Steve Gerber came up with Howard the Duck. And I would really move across the spectrum from doing a very realistic style to caricature, and then different kinds of caricature. I did some Al Hirschfeld style caricatures. Most of the time I was doing a modified Mort Drucker style. Mort Drucker's the cartoonist who does the movie parodies in Mad Magazine. But it really wasn't until pretty late in Cerebus. It's a 16-volume series, and it was in volume 15 that I ended up doing a Woody Allen character named Konigsberg, and actually there's an extended fantasy sequence in there where Königsberg is imagining himself in different Fellini and Bergman films. And I decided to just go very literal with it and find books on Bergman and Fellini that had stills from their movies and trace it off as exactly as possible. And that really scratched an itch. That was, look at me, Ma, I'm Al Williamson. And that got filed away mentally as I think if I ever get back to doing this crazy thing for a living again, this is something that I want to do. I don't know if that's just because I didn't get to do enough of it on Cerebus, but I think it's really very, very deep in my blood, and it's largely a forgotten, largely ignored, largely looked down upon kind of style, and that's very strange to me, because to me, Alex Raymond on Rip Kirby, Stan Drake on Heart of Juliet Jones, Neil Adams on Ben Casey, Al Williamson on Secret Agent Corrigan, all of this stuff's going back to the 50s and 60s and 70s, and really vanished as something that people even did in comics. And to me, it's the best stuff. Colin, you're not a fan at all of photorealism. Right?
How
you
did you
read
know
him
that?
Like a book?
Oh, I knew that already.
Well, I just don't. I don't think when you do photorealism, I feel that you just don't use comics to its full potential of caricature and exaggeration. I don't understand the points of doing it.
I can understand what you're saying there, but I have to admit you're wrong. No, it's definitely a I don't know how unique a preference it is. It definitely fell out of fashion in the comic book field. But what's been interesting is the number of guys who have turned out to be closet photorealism fans.
Well, like. Neil
go
Adams.
Ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, Neil Adams is very influential among a majority of comic artists, not even if they don't realize it.
Yes. There's Neil Adams is an interesting case because he came from the newspaper strip end of things. He did the strip Ben Casey, which was based on the television show, and was very much in the photorealism tradition, and then he moved over into comic books because that was pretty much the time when Ben Casey came to an end, and he did a certain number of other things. But by the late 1960s, the writing was on the wall for narrative comic strips, so he moved over to DC Comics and did Dead Man and the Spectre and Batman, and in a lot of ways, the rates were so low at DC, he really couldn't afford to take the time with super realistic drawing and actually taking photographs and things as he did with Ben Casey and with his advertising work, and basically developed a whole new way of doing very realistic but very exaggerated anatomy and a very exaggerated way of looking at comics that was sort of a mix of the photorealism style mixed in with Jack Kirby. The thing of having to fill a whole page with as few figures as you can and make it look as dynamic as you can because... you're really only getting $40 a page, so you got to turn out those pages.
And one little tidbit of trivia about Neil Adams is he was the youngest guy doing one of those strips, I think, ever. when he did, when he got started.
As a matter of fact, when he signed to do Ben Casey, if he had been 3 months younger, I think it was, his mother would have had to sign the contract for him. he was a real child prodigy. He worked at Johnstone and Cushing, which was an advertising agency that specialized in doing comics for advertising that virtually got eliminated when television became the preeminent advertising medium. But Neil Adams went up there when he was 18 or 19. He was recommended by Elmer Wexler, and he had been working there for about a year and a half. He came in on his birthday, and they had this whole birthday party set up for him. And, they had drinks and food and everything, and he's going, oh, you know, this is really great, but I really don't understand why you guys are doing this. And one of them put his arm around Neil, and he said, Neil, today, as of today, we no longer have to go home and tell our wives that we're getting our asses beaten by a teenager. He had just turned 20 years old, so... He was amazing.
Yeah,
He still is.
Yeah, we actually, Neil was one of the first guys I had on the show, I think, within the first, like, 3 months. A couple of years ago now, and I was very happy to get the chance to talk to him.
So I was just wondering, with the photorealism, have you actually used models at all yet, or is all this from magazines and already existing photos?
It's all from magazines, basically... looking at the photos in the top fashion magazines, and just trying to find the models and the clothes that look the most like an Alex Raymond or Al Williamson drawing, and because it's pretty labor intensive, trying to get a likeness, which is something that I'm trying to wean myself away from. It's not necessary to get an exact likeness. It's better to get as pretty a drawing as I can. So, you know, there is room to change what's there, but I prefer to work the other way. First of all, getting it as exact as possible, until I know how to do that, and then taking the knowledge that I get from that, and then start improvising or changing things around. I'm still using way too much pen for my satisfaction. The amazing thing to me about Alex Raymond and Al Williamson is that almost everything is done with a brush, and a very fine brush, and you've got the one chance to get the line right, and that's the only chance that you've got. It can take...
No whiteout allowed.
Pardon me?
No whiteout allowed.
No whiteout allowed. Well, I broke that rule pretty quick. I try not to use very much of it, but sometimes, boy, I gotta get that whiteout happening, and it's just dazzling to me that these guys could work as many hours as they did penciling and getting the image right in pencil, and then in order to get it to look right, in order to get it actually into the Raymond School. The inking has to be done very, very spontaneously, very, very Zen-like, very, Japanese calligraphy kind of thing. And as I said at the start of the show, I'm not a real spontaneous kind of guy when it comes to working on my artwork. But if you get it right, if you can just get everything pulling together. And, take a few deep breaths, tell yourself you know how to do this, and then just swip, 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 and there it is for you know, win, lose, or draw, good, bad, or indifferent. That's how I did this time.
The magic of the
pen.
Of
course, now I've been promoting the book for 3 months since the beginning of December, so I have to go back and relearn everything that I already learned the first time.
Now, one question, talking about the promoting, I mean, it's been pretty evident of you've really been pushing this, contacting all these stores and getting in touch with people, soliciting.
The website, www.glamourpusscomic.com. Wasn't that smooth?
There we go, just a little tossing.
Hardly noticed it.
One thing that you're noted for is... As you're known for your points of view as much as for your comics in the comic industry. I think that's pretty good way of putting it. And I don't necessarily agree with a fair amount of points of view, but in your process of doing this, is there any kind of regret of making statements as far as like alienating readership?
Not really. No, I think, you know, I'm one of those people that thinks there's not quite as much of a universal consensus everywhere in society on every point that I don't think we're anywhere near as a society to being able to even play with the idea of such a thing as being politically correct. I mean, the abortion debate alone, that's right down the line. That's 50-50. And if you've got central issues in society that half of the population thinks one way and half of the population thinks another way, I really don't think that it makes very much sense to say, okay, well, we've got that settled. I think, on the contrary, I think the more that we talk about, you know, different viewpoints, and the more that that we can advance different viewpoints, you know, that's what separates us from Iran.
I'm being careful because I don't want to get into the viewpoint stuff, to the like ideological discussion or stuff, because there's a lot of comics to talk about. So just those that are listening. That's why I'm not following up with more, maybe. Maybe we can have another discussion another time. But we're talking about the comics, and there is some important comic work. And I guess my question is, the other side to your coming up stuff, is, and I know it's something you're not planning on really discussing very much because it's very personal to you, is your project Judenhaus. Working on that, is Glamourpus a kind of way of leveling yourself to take away from, I guess, the emotional impact of working on that kind of project?
Judenhaus was definitely a debilitating experience, but then I really intended it to be that way. Being a non-Jew, I definitely think that... non-Jews around the world haven't really accepted the level of personal culpability for what all non-Jews have been doing to Jews, you know, from time immemorial. The Shoah was definitely a culmination, but to me it was under no circumstances an exceptional event. It was, as I say in the beginning part of the book, I think it was pretty much inevitable once you start looking at the history of the non-Jewish world.
Maybe we should just let people know what...
I've gotten the book done. It's an experiment, well, you know, not just in the subject matter, but also in the way that the artwork is done, of trying to make use of the computer a little more extensively, in that the drawings are scanned in, but there's also a lot of panning and zooming in. I'm gonna have to I'm afraid, quote a website again. If you go to www.judenhass.com, J-U-D-E-N-H-A-S-S, and you look at the first page and pages, I believe it's 3 and 4 or 4 and 5, it's an approach shot to the railway entrance to Auschwitz-Birkenau, and that's taken from one drawing. Because it's been scanned in, you can just say, okay, now I've scanned in this one panoramic drawing of that, and now I can enlarge that drawing progressively. I think it's about 10%, 15% each time, and that creates the illusion that you're moving closer to it.
How big was the original for that piece?
What's that?
How big was the original piece?
It's 11 by 17. 11 by 17.
But you got some pretty good detail in it then.
Yeah, there was a lot of challenges trying to pick up all of the pen work, which was very, very fine. But that whole stage of, you know, once I had drawn the whole thing, and my technical director Lou Copeland, I sent him photocopied mock-ups of the enlargements and reductions and how large the different panels were going to be and whatnot, which was a lot of work for him to do. So there was really this time period where I couldn't really do anything else on Judenhass because all of this needed to be done. So that was really where I thought, okay, this was a pretty excruciating 3 years that it took me to do the 48 pages. So now I think I'm going to try and have something that's just a lot of fun.
What was it like doing, I guess, for want of a better word, background? Because for so many years in Cerebus, you had Gerhard doing your backgrounds.
Yes. Well, that was really one of the experiments that we never got to was how is it possible? Would it have been possible to save time by doing, as an example, a master background and then scanning the background and basically putting it in behind the characters? And I think the fact that it took 3 years to get Judenhass done will tell you that, no, this is not particularly a time saver. The whole cutting and pasting thing, which I really didn't understand, the way that works on a computer, is pretty laborious work for somebody to have to do. Lou did a spectacular job on it and was very, very patient because on Cerebus, obviously, if you're doing a monthly comic book, for 300 issues, 26 years, it's as good as you can make it in that month. So this was going to be my one time of saying, I'm going to labor over these pictures, and I'm not letting go of the pictures until the pictures are exactly the way I want them, and I'm not going to press until all of the computer work looks exactly the way that I wanted it to. And I don't know that I would ever do it again. I don't know that there was really that big a difference. I think I draw as good as I draw, and taking a maximum amount of time with it at a specific point, you're just adding more pen lines in. But it was definitely something that I wanted to do once, and I think Gerhard's doing having the same sort of experience. He's doing a series of prints called World Without Cerebus that are just watercolor backgrounds. And definitely that was his motivation. I want to do single pieces that I only work on when I'm motivated, and that I want to put the time in, as much time as it's going to take to get it right.
Do you think you and Gerhard will work on a project together at some time in the future?
I would doubt it. I would doubt it. Gerhardt was never a comic book fan.
Mm.
He was never especially interested in comic books. And as Colin can tell you, there's really nothing more time-consuming than producing a comic book. I would say the only creative medium that's more time-consuming than comics is classic animation, but comic books is really a good runner-up to that, because, you know, for one thing, most of the time you're doing it all by yourself, and unless you really have comic books in your blood from a very early age, which, Colin, you were like that, right?
Oh, yeah. Into the Tintin and the Hergé.
Got bit by the bug.
Asterix.
Yeah. And if it's your thing, then, you know, you really don't notice how much time it's eating up. But with Gerhardt, it was, you know, this was an interesting thing to do, and it was, you know, definitely a more than full-time job for, you know, his 20s, 30s, and part of his 40s. But I suspect he's done now. Certainly the offer's always on the table if he wants to do another comic book. But I've said to him, you know, one of the things that you get in the Alex Raymond School and Al Williamson is these gorgeous shots of cars done in the photorealism style. So I've definitely put the offer on the table that Gerhardt's welcome to do as many cars as he's interested in doing at, you know, X number of dollars a car.
Cars are tough.
What's that?
Cars are tough.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember Bernie Wrightson. I was talking to him about Swamp Thing number one, and I forget what the... He had a sports car in there. I think it was... a Porsche or something like that. And I remember him saying he always wondered what happened to those guys in high school that's all they could draw. all they did was sit all day and knock out cars in their notebooks, and they could do a three-quarter view of a Porsche, you know, just in their sleep, because they love cars the way we love comics. And it's probably something that's worth looking into. You know, take out an ad in some high school newspapers to go on My Face or whatever that thing is called. And, you know, say, if you're in high school and you draw cars, have we got a job for you? You can do cars in every comic book coming out right now.
There we go. A whole generation of Gerhardts just waiting.
Now, the same way that Ben Oda used to letter all of the newspaper strips. Most of the cartoonists in New York had given Ben Oda the keys to their apartments, so he could just let himself in and letter their strips at night while they were sleeping. We could just give this guy the keys to all of our places, and he could let himself in and draw sports cars.
Maybe Colin will stop doing historical comics now.
I've just started.
Further back than sports cars?
Yes, well.
Okay.
We won't get into that right now, because we're talking about you.
Okay.
It's all about you,
Dave. It was a nice try, though.
Now, working on Judenhaus, did you want the reason, like, when you started it, did you feel like your own personal skills were at a point where you could attempt an ambitious project?
It was certainly a stretch. It was... I mean, the danger with doing anything having to do with the Shoah is that you don't want to trivialize it, and you don't want to commercialize it, and you certainly don't want to miss having the proper effect and, you know, having people respond to it the way that you hope that they will respond to it. It was definitely pulling a lot of skills together, and having to look at it from as many angles as possible, having to look at it not only as you need to do with comic books just as a medium. You always have to be looking at the pages that you've got done and looking at them through fresh eyes and always anticipating, is somebody going to misunderstand what they're looking at here, or is somebody going to infer wrongly what it is that that I was trying to imply here? And there's such a variety of ways that, that different people read different things that that was, I would say that was probably one of the biggest parts of the project, was just a lot of just sitting and staring at the pages that were done and saying, okay, what's the next natural page, and what's the best approach to that page, and does this, do the pages that I've got done so far actually say what I want them to say? I ended up putting the work aside for a month at a time, 2 months at a time, because it's just, I'm sitting here and staring at it, and I'm still going around the same circle. I'm not coming up with any answers. And, you know, again, that was really factored in as this is a core element of this project. If I've been staring at these three pages for 2 weeks and I'm not getting any answers, then the only answer is to put the pages away and then pull them out fresh a couple of weeks from now and see if I come up with a different answer. Whereas when you're working on a monthly comic or a bi-monthly comic like Glamour Puss is,
you just don't have the chance.
At some point, you've got to just flip a coin and say, well, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, because I can't, time's wasting. I can't just sit here and stare at these pages. I got to draw some stuff.
Have you read about what Art Spiegelman went through after he finished Mouse?
Yeah.
I'm just seeing like some linkages, because he went through really, really heavy.
Oh, no. That's, I'm sure that's,
just,
that's,
I mean,
completely different. That's one of the things that I'm trying to get across is, I think there's a world of difference between the Jewish experience of the Shoah and the non-Jewish experience of the Shoah. I can subject myself to, let me rephrase that.
Mm-hmm.
I can do what I think is an appropriate penance, but the non-Jewish experience of the Shoah will never be even within quantum leagues of the Jewish experience. And I think that's important to understand. I mean, I do say even in the work that I think everyone should do something on the Shoah at some point, but there's no question, and particularly non-Jews as a form of penance. But I can't even imagine what it would be like to be a Jew in the world, knowing that the Holocaust took place, knowing what happened, and that this was, you know, just a traditional way of dealing with the Jews. It was really just, the only difference was severity. It was always taken as a given that, you know, the best behavior was to treat Jews badly.
I'm presuming you've read up on the programs of Russia and stuff like related documentation of,
yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely staggering to see how many people in what appears to be good conscience all behaved that way. It was interesting to me reading the collected letters of Ernest Hemingway when I was doing the research for Form and Void. He, you know, it's not heavy-handed Jew hatred, and I do see it as Jew hatred, not anti-Semitism. But it is definitely there in his postscripts, and you know, calling himself Hemingstein and things like that. Just thinking that this is, you know, I'm just making a joke. And you, I do notice that, or I did notice reading his letters, that drops off to virtually nothing in, you know, mid-1945, obviously, when the camps were liberated.
And people found out what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I am trying to reawaken with Judenhaus, because it is very graphic. It is... you know, there are a lot of drawings that are done from, you know, the corpses that were just stacked like cordwood at Auschwitz-Birkenau. That's the part to me that we can't forget. You can't start laundering the Holocaust and you know, cleaning it up. They've already cleaned up Auschwitz so that, you know, it's a pristine looking place.
It's a tourist visitation
and,
area.
You know, I'm not sure that was a particularly good idea. And, you know, a lot of the Holocaust museums are falling into line with that as well. You know, we've got families coming in and we don't want to disturb small children. And it's like, well, I think you have to disturb small children. I think Colin, you grew up pretty much the same time period that I did, and you saw, you know, in history class the films of the bulldozers, you know, just plowing all of these corpses into the giant mass graves.
My high school history teacher, Mr. Krieger, brought in, I think it was an uncle who had escaped from Germany just before the war.
Well,
just before the camps, so, and he spoke to our class and told us about what it was like in Nazi Germany before the war. So yeah, we saw that stuff.
Yeah, I don't think we do ourselves a service as a society by trying to clean that up or trying to keep that away because people have sensitivities. I'm sort of hoping that Judenhaus might find a place in classrooms. You know, pick your grade level. I realize that people don't share my viewpoint to any great extent. So, you know, pick it, grade 8, grade 9, grade 10, grade 11, whichever one you're going to do, and say, okay, we don't want to traumatize them by showing them the films or showing them the actual photographs, but these are drawings done from the photographs. You know, maybe that's one of those, it's enough of a step removed that, you know, I'm hoping a certain number of people will see the logic in, you have to really look at what was done, not just allude to it.
Now, if people want to check out the book, they can go to the website, Judenhass, did I get it right, .com?
Judenhass.
There we go. Now, and also stores will have it available for people to check out too, won't they?
Yes, there will be an advance preview edition that's going to be going to all of the comic book stores in North America. They should be getting that around March 12th as part of Diamond Dateline. And you should be able to go into pretty much any comic book store about mid-March and just ask to see the preview edition of Judenhaus. And as I did with Glamour Puss. I like to leave it up to the individual to look at it themselves and, you know, again, win, lose, or draw, win, place, or show. I'll accept the decision of anybody, whether they want to buy this or whether they don't.
And we actually borrowed RX Comics edition today for bringing into the discussion. So I could look at the Glamour Puss, and we only have about, I'd say, 7 or 8 minutes left. So we'll ask a couple more questions about Glamour Puss.
Okay.
Since that's the next thing coming out, the book reads like a dissertation on L. Williamson and Alex Raymond. What can we expect in the comic? Is it going to be more discussion of the artwork, or will it be more character-driven?
More recipes?
So far, I'm about two-thirds of the way through issue number two. At least what I'm trying to do right now is to have sort of a 50-50 balance between the fashion magazine parody, you know, that wonderful, wacky fashion magazine voice that, to me, has just been begging for a parody. I want to do about half the book that way, but I don't think that's something that would sustain a bi-monthly comic book for very long. So that's why I'm sort of doing that and then, you know, explaining why it is that I'm doing this, what it is that appeals to me about the Alex Raymond style, and what I see as the sort of ongoing artistic debate that started with Alex Raymond, and Stan Drake came along doing Heart of Juliet Jones and was sort of an Alex Raymond heretic. He did several things that Alex Raymond wouldn't have approved of. And then Neil Adams sort of came along and did to Stan Drake what Stan Drake did to Alex Raymond. And throughout that, Al Williamson was just faithfully following along behind Alex Raymond. I'm going to turn myself into the best Alex Raymond that I can. And
one similarity between the two books, between Glamour Puss and Judenhaus, is how much you wear your influences on your sleeve, because in Judenhaus, in the preview, you discuss some pretty prominent, important Jewish-American cartoonists, Jack Kirby, Will Eisner, you know, list goes
Stan Lee,
on.
Joe Simon, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How important for you is it to kind of embrace those and promote your roots?
Oh, critically important to me. And it's one of the things that I'm hoping, again, you know, with an eye to the schools, is it's often very difficult to explain to children, you know, exactly how significant the Holocaust is. And I'm hoping, you know, in a way it's kind of trivializing it, but just pointing out that virtually all of the, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, these people who founded the comic book industry back in the 1930s, were virtually all Jews. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the reason that they were in the comic industry is because they were pretty much blackballed everywhere else. You couldn't get work as an illustrator if you were Jewish. So they needed something that was just so badly thought of that, geez, even Jews are allowed to do this.
And some of them love comics, too.
Well, yeah, and definitely I always try and acknowledge, you know, the guys that came before and just how important they are to me. The same as, you know, Colin mentioning Tintin and Asterix, and, you know, we don't want to forget that none of us sprang full-blown from the head of Zeus.
Well, before we were cartoonists, we were fans.
Yeah, yes. Chester Brown, perfect example with his almost slavish devotion to Harold Gray, who did Little Orphan Annie. And, you know, that was one of those things. It helps being a friend of Chester Brown, so I go, well, he can do it for Harold Gray. Why can't I do it for Al Williamson? You know, we're all falling along behind somebody. Al Williamson was falling along behind Alex Raymond, and turns out Alex Raymond was following along behind, you know, X number of illustrators.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting to look at the development in art, because it's kind of interesting looking, and there are some modern guys who are really pushing forward too, like someone like Dave Mazzucchelli, who his own style, you know, utilized all these different elements, but is totally pushing this whole new way of doing comics as well.
Yeah, well, it's like Robert Crumb said, it's only lines on paper, folks. And but there's so many different ways of doing those lines, and you know, it's very interesting just looking at all of the traditions. I'm in, as I said, Columbus, Ohio right now, and I was it was kind of nice to pick up the first issue of Jeff Smith's Wrassel at the Laughing Ogre here in town, and just looking at all the brushwork on there.
Mm-hmm.
The people at the Cartoon Arts Studies program at OSU actually gave Jeff some of Milt Kniff's old paintbrushes.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, that's one of those things. That'll bring you to the drawing board with a spirit of reverence.
Good Lord.
That's fantastic.
You make sure you wash those at the end of the day. Unlike the rest of us who just let the ink build up on there until they're no good.
What are they, Series 7?
What's that?
Are they Series 7?
I think so.
Wow.
I
heard Will Eisner said he wants to use the same Series 7 brush for decades.
Yeah, Will actually wanted to get his whole studio using Japanese brushes.
Really?
Because they were so cheap.
Oh.
He could get them for like 15 cents instead of $2 or whatever the brushes were. But it turned out he and Lou Fine were the only two guys that had a delicate enough touch that they knew how to use these. And everybody else went, Will, I can't use this. This is like inking with a piece of spaghetti.
What brush are you inking with now?
I'm using a real skinny brush, just a kind of...
Zero? Size?
Yeah, not zero. It's probably about a 2 or something. And it's one of those. I think I found the thoroughbred dog in the pack, which is always the problem. I went back to the same art store in Toronto that Chester and I go to when I'm in Toronto, and hey, I got to pick up like 3 more of those, and I picked up a couple more, but I'm still using the same one, and I've got this awful feeling that when I use the other two, it's going to be, no, that was just one of those A++ brushes. The magic brush you only find once in your life, like Barry Windsor Smith and his magic pencil that he wanted to have framed, that he was in this absolute mental block, couldn't draw anything, and then just had this weird pencil, wasn't even like an art pencil of any kind, and, you know, knocked out 4 beautiful pictures in 2 days or something, and is convinced it must have been the pencil that did it.
Of course.
I want to thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Robin.
It's the end of our hour, and I have the next show staring at me. Thank you so much for taking the time with us, and I look forward to Judenhaus and Glamour Puss. And for those in Columbus, I guess they can see the art from Judenhaus at Space.
Yep, they can check out the information on the web at Back Porch Comics, or they could just Google Space. And
they might have problems Googling Space.
Thanks for having Colin as part of this.
Oh, Colin's
the dean of Canadian mini-comics.
You know, but Chester was doing minis before him, though.
Well, yeah, but...
are you sure of that?
850,000 of them.
Yeah. No.
Chester stopped after, I think, 7 or 8.
Yeah. I think I just really pissed off Colin. So, no, Colin is a regular host of the Ink Studs.
Yeah.
And he's an institution here.
Nice talking to you,
and
Dave.
You're darned lucky to have him.
He reminds me every day. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, guys. Have a good night.
You bye too. Bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
cartoonist Dave Sim, talking about his books. As I said before, I don't necessarily share a lot of the same viewpoints as Dave Sim, but he did do a lot of good comics, and I think it's important for us to discuss them. And yeah, enjoy. Up next is Crimes and Treasons. And yeah. Oh, next week, I should mention what's on for the next month. We do our Women in Comics Month. So every March we interview nothing but women. So next week will be Francois Moulet, co-editor of Raw Magazine, as well as her online Toon Books, Comics for Kids, and Phoebe Gleckner will be on next month. Diana Schutz, Megan Kelso, as well as a whole slew of exclusive online interviews, of which I will post the first one on Saturday. Surprise, surprise, who will it be? Thanks, Dave, for joining us. Up next, Crimes and Treasons, and yeah, bye.
One, two, three, four, action.
She's a glamour girl, she stands so still, wears a feathered bra, her hair so high. It starts to sway when she brushes her teeth 5 times a day. Burlesque attitude, nighttime frills. She's a glamour girl, and her look just kills. Beware of her kiss, she'll suck you in 5 times a day.